With Hyphen Magazine, I'm Christian Ting, our TV and film editor, with a special edition of our Hyphen in Hollywood Entertainment podcast. In this podcast, we have a very special guest, none other than Cal Penn, star, creator, and producer of Sunnyside on NBC. Cal, good afternoon. How's it going?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. We're having a glorious day in West Hollywood at the Pale House, looking over a view of a non-smoky or charred Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's a little windy, too. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Santa Ana winds hopefully won't give us any type of pains or coughs, but for the most part, it's been really idyllic. So speaking of which, you know, we are so excited to have you for this podcast and for our community today. Just there's been a litany of questions that our viewers have kind of proposed to us regarding your time specifically with the latest NBC show, Sunnyside. First of all, congratulations on just developing the show and kind of getting it off the ground. And
thank you. Yeah, it was an awesome experience developing it with Matt Murray, my co-creator, and Mike Schur and our whole team. So it was, you know, most shows don't make it past the sort of conception stage, and then so getting to do the pilot and then a series that that even added an additional episode has been a dream, literally.
I love that, and I think, you know, just to jump right into the gate here, throughout your story career, for us as fans, as viewers, you know, it's been clear that your dual passions for politics and entertainment would eventually intersect in some creative capacity, as they have in the past.
Yeah.
We got a taste of that with your role as Seth in Designated Survivor.
Sure.
And now recently with your current role as Garrett Modi, who actually shares your actual last name, yeah, if I'm correct, in Sunnyside. I'm sure there was some deliberation there. So just on that, you know, and you mentioned too, but like, take us through sort of the ideation and development of the show from the ground up.
Yeah.
The concept to the completion, and specifically also about the development of your character.
Sure.
Garrett.
So our show is, we like to say it's a patriotic comedy. It's about a group of immigrants in New York City who are trying to go through the U.S. citizenship process. And I take them under my wing after I lose a very coveted job that I've had for 15 years as New York City's youngest elected city council member. So the backstory is that for 15 years I was in New York City Council, did absolutely no work. So I just ended up getting reelected again and again because nobody pays attention. And then one day, 15 years in, I am arrested for being drunk on the BQE, which is a highway that goes through New York City. Try to bribe a cop. And there's footage of this, and so I end up losing my job. And I have to post an ad on Craigslist. Because I have no other job skills. So I post an ad on Craigslist saying, you know, for $50 an hour, I'll do whatever you want. And I have to do a lot of dehumanizing things. And then finally, this group of five immigrants hires me for what's supposed to be a day to help them study for a citizenship test. And they find out slowly that I actually know even less than they do. They actually know quite a bit. And so then, that's sort of the setup for what's basically a sitcom about a group of friends. So initially, I had the idea for this about 5 years ago where I thought, what I loved about the Harold and Kumar movies are that they're aspirational. And the type of humor that we go for is never cutting anybody else down. All right, so the Harold and Kumar movies, bizarre and weird and fun and obviously diverse. And the content is, the type of humor, I think, is, it comes from these grounded characters that you fall in love with because they remind you of people in your own lives. And so I wanted to tell a story like that that was diverse and that was inclusive and told our stories in a way that is also accessible to every audience member. And so I was on a show at the time that was sort of short-lived, and when that ended, my manager and producing partner, Dan Spilo, said, "What's your dream job? Like, what would you really, really want to do?" And I said, well, if I created a show, I would want it to be, you know, and listed off all of these things. I want it to be sort of like what we watched growing up, where I want it to be a show where you turn off the TV at the end of the night and you feel good. You feel like you've hung out with a group of your friends.
Yeah.
So put it on hold because of Designated Survivor. And then when Designated Survivor ended last year, had the chance to really develop Sunnyside and partnered with Matt Murray, who's my co-creator, Mike Schur, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And NBC and Universal, and it was an amazing experience because we also, in those 5 years, obviously the world has changed and the country's changed and we're a lot more polarized than we were even 5 years ago, and immigration obviously is way more topical. It's never not been topical.
Right.
It's a nation of immigrants, but it's in the public eye a little more, and so we thought, wow, what an interesting time to sort of, you know, develop this. And certainly the show is not a reaction to anything that's happening
right
now. we were founded on immigration, and that's a beautiful thing. But the fact that it's relevant now is also meaningful, I think, to a lot of folks, ourselves included, to be able to tell these stories.
I think it's fascinating that sort of the timeline here you're working with is like you mentioned that, you know, 5 years ago from this date, which puts you kind of like from an administration standpoint in between two different administrations in terms of our own personal politics. And kind of you, I imagine, between your work with your current shows, kind of taking note of like what was happening within the political zeitgeist. Like, did that kind of like, were you ruminating on ways that your show would kind of have a different resonance depending on how things had panned out in the political sphere? Did you kind of like take an inventory of like how you wanted to kind of modify things, or was it always going to be one stable product?
No, I think, you know, the show is not a reaction to the sort of Republican tyranny that's taking place right now. And it was important for it to not be a reaction. You know, part of it is just like, these guys obviously get off on everyone's reactions. I'm like, don't really want to take your bait.
Yeah.
But also, we are a beautiful nation of immigrants, and the story that we want to tell is one that is patriotic and is inclusive and is the vision of America that we know actually does exist. And there's humor in that. And so, you know, the point of the show is to make people laugh. And so when we put the characters together, we put them together based on people that we really knew. And, you know, yes, I had the chance to work on outreach around the DREAM Act, for example, when I was at the White House.
Yeah.
That didn't necessarily play a role in putting the show together, but it did play a role in how we crafted the characters. You know, we have one of the five folks is undocumented. The rest come from very different immigration backgrounds. So I think initially, no, it didn't have anything to do with what was happening politically. But then you also realize it does say a lot when we have an opportunity to tell immigrant stories at a time when, you know, half the country is not necessarily friendly to new immigrants right now.
And at the very least, to give people a chance to have an exposure to different cultures and just an introduction to just dialogue and rhetoric and faces that ordinarily wouldn't be seen in the day-to-day.
Right. So I think,
there's a lot of latent power in that kind of being expressed through the vehicle that is a show. So, I mean, that's a perfect segue to kind of like, in the show and in sort of the nucleus of it, having seen the series myself, I was just amazed at how many specific cultural intersections happen that play out between characters, from Hakeem's character's misunderstanding of American terms that are a little more salacious and how he kind of misinterprets that to being explained by your sister character Mallory, and to the tongue-in-cheek. And I think what's so timely about this is like the characters of Mei Lin as well as Joel Kim Booster's character, how they are like the crazy rich dumb Asians who just are so flagrantly oblivious to wealth and privilege. And I think how there's a light tongue-in-cheek kind of ribbing of that on Oris, because having gone to Berkeley, I saw so many kids pulling up in Maseratis, Lamborghinis with their Gucci boots, just unaware of just what that material is and its process. So
it's funny so for us, those two characters are actually based on an Icelandic family that that Matt knows, or Matt used to know, I guess. So a lot of folks make the obvious Crazy Rich Asians comparison, but it actually has nothing to do with that movie or even, you know, that sort of world. But then when we were crafting the characters, we knew we obviously want a whole bunch of representation. And the two Asian American characters, you know, we originally, they are brother and sister, but we cast a wide net, and we told Allison Jones, who's our casting director, really the mandate for her was bring us the funniest people, period.
Gotcha.
And so different iterations of the script had different ethnicities. I think Griselda's character in previous iterations was El Salvadorian and then Mexican, and now she's Dominican because Diana Maria Riva, who plays her, is Dominican. So for the twins, for Mei Lin and Jun Ho, we knew that they were going to be the kids of a billionaire dad. And then Joel Kim Booster and Poppy Liu both crushed their auditions. They're so funny. Joel, obviously Korean-American. Poppy's Chinese-American. One thing that, you know, obviously rubs me the wrong way is when Hollywood goes, oh, well, everybody looks the same. It's fine. And I think that's, you know, it's lazy more than it even is anything else.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, instead of being reductive, why don't we actually heighten the humor here? And instead of, you know, traditional, I think, producing, they would just go, okay, well, either let's say everybody looks the same, or let's just find two people from the same ethnicity. And in our case, the humor was the most important thing. Yeah. And so they have the same dad, who's a billionaire, but they're born to two different moms at the same time at the same hospital. So we thought, why not just lean into it and make it even weirder and funnier? That's sort of what we're going for anyway. So I think, putting the cast together, like, it's more about what's funny and weird and bizarre, but they're grounded in real experiences. You know, this Icelandic family that Matt knew, or the Brady character, who's based on a couple of people who I knew who are undocumented. I think the Hakeem character is loosely based on a doctor who Matt knew, who was selling cars. He was actually Italian, and you know Hakeem's character obviously is Ethiopian. So, so yeah, there's specificity and there's representation that comes from a real place, and that was important to us.
I love it. I said as sort of as an anecdote as well for the undocumented character and Brady, his background as Moldovan, I think really illustrates something that isn't really covered is that. The idea that in our current climate, we always assume that dreamers are one particular race. They assume that they're either Latinx or are, you know, from other parts of the country, but that they can also be Caucasian as well.
Yeah.
I think that is a decision I'm sure was made within the writer's room, within the development of this character, to be like, hey, this is, again, exposure to a different type of person that we don't get to see very often as well.
Yeah, look, I wanted Brady to be white. I thought it was important that that character was white, and it's also truthful. He's loosely based on a guy I know in Detroit who's a Russian immigrant, didn't know that he was undocumented, grew up in Detroit. When he was 16, he went to go get his driver's license and found out by the lady at the DMV that he's not here legally. And she said, you know, you should leave. I could call the cops. And he went home and said to his parents, I was trying to surprise you by getting my driver's license. Are we not here with papers? Are we undocumented? And found out, yes, he was undocumented or is undocumented. Right. So a couple years after that, he was picked up by ICE and was in detention for a while. And the job that he had when he was picked up by ICE was he was an English teacher for inner city kids in Detroit. So that is literally the job he had when ICE decided to pick him up and put him in detention. So it was important to, you know, whatever the Brady character ended up looking like, you know, would have been authentic, but I kind of loosely did want to base it on this Russian guy I knew, and I thought, to your point, there oftentimes when we think about undocumented stories, the media narrative is, okay, these are brown folks.
Yeah.
And they're not all brown folks, and there's quite a few undocumented young people who come from all different places around the world, and so, yeah, we wanted to make sure that folks are represented.
And I think that's a perfect segue to just, like, my discussion, and just want to just, like, say that the show's temerity to just jump into tough and often uncomfortable issues is manifested in episode 3 for, it's called Dr. Potato, where we discuss sort of how the character of Drazen is basically taken into ICE custody. And there's a specific moment I want to kind of highlight and call in, was that when your character goes into the ICE detainment center with Brady, and how he kind of issues his uncomfortableness about that, and how there's like a very real moment that happens, arguably within, as you describe, a patriotic comedy, that I think is so important to like adding dimension to what comedy can be to, as a way to like address issues that are oftentimes categorically like uncomedic.
Yeah.
And that was a very, for me, like watching it the past couple of days, like it just drew me into like the humanity of what these people go through
and, thank
and
you.
How to address it. Yeah. Like, it really struck me as like, wow.
We were going for that. You know, we're a comedy, but that doesn't mean that every single moment has to be either outlandishly comedic or darkly serious. And finding that balance was important because that's sort of the space in which I think a lot of our communities live. And it's the way people live. You want it to be meaningful and resonate and have it be relevant. Also, there's like really dark humor in that. That episode, you really learn what an idiot Garrett is. My character, because Drazen comes out for his ICE hearing, and Garrett runs over to him, and I say, Drazen, how are you? Is everything okay? And he says, yeah, it's not so bad. And then my idiot character goes, oh, really? And he goes, no, of course not. Yeah. It's terrible. I'm in ICE custody. I'm in detention. It's awful. Right? And you realize, like, I'm just that stupid. Mm-hmm. And so there is, like, there's a lot of humor in it, but also we're pointing out things that are tough that communities are dealing with, and we wanted to be honest about all that.
Yeah, in a way that's fastened not around like as a critique of the failure, the ineptitude of the political system, because I think one thing that really brings me to the show more is that Garrett's own arc of kind of coming to his own sort of lack of perspective, but also like knowing when you have those moments with the music changes and you have those hero bits where you can try to salvage and just maintain some type of integrity of the situation that I think lend itself to what you mentioned as like the feel-good moment that you want to arrive at an aspirational context. So
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of times there's fumbles in it, and there's inroads and there's impasses and blocks, but I think that that comes with the experience of dealing with just tenuous topics and whatnot, too. So
and the characters themselves are purposely flawed, right? There's nothing more boring than one-dimensional characters.
Right.
And that also tends to be super reductionist, and you see that a lot, particularly when it comes to Asian American representation, is 100%. Characters are very reductionist, they're one-dimensional, and this absurd view that something is either positive or negative, mm-hmm. right? That there's just a binary way of looking at characters. And both of those options are dehumanizing in different ways, because you need the complexity of a character for the humanity to exist, and that's what we're also making sure we have on the show.
Especially, and I love you mentioned that, Cal, within the lens of there are so few roles afforded in the first place to our community. It's almost just like this idea of like begging for the scraps that are allotted from a casting perspective, from a showrunning perspective.
Yeah.
How do we accomplish this goal and this aim of really demonstrating just the nuance and the subtlety and just the multidimensionalness of who these characters are? And I think it's an endeavor that seems almost like out of bounds sometimes. But I think for you kind of being the position you are in your leadership as, you know, a voice for our community, just like finding ways to like give those opportunities, you know.
Well, thank you. Look, there are a lot of amazing artists and content creators that are doing that. It's important to me, so I want to do it. I'm also, you know, it's our community, and we want to make sure that our stories are told. But there's no shortage of talent, right?
Absolutely.
I think the biggest misnomer that folks don't even talk about as much as I wish they would is that there is so much talent out there. Anytime you see a cast that is not diverse, or a writer's room, or a production office, for that matter, it's not because the talent doesn't exist, it's because somebody made a choice not to be diverse or not to represent what America actually looks like. And that's a choice they made, that's, you know, their preference for whatever the reason is. But we had no shortage of actors reading for all of these roles. We tweaked the ethnicities or their countries of origin to the cast we ended up going with. Our writer's room is also the most diverse in Hollywood. We hear in Hollywood history, same with the show on camera. And we're really proud of that, but there was no shortage of comedic, qualified, diverse voices
Absolutely.
To fill these rooms. So anytime you know, and it requires networks and production companies and studios to not just invest in these stories, but then support them and make sure that they're on the air and they're picking up shows like this, and that they're, you know, because they do well. They do well when they're supported, but when they're not supported, you know, you obviously see what happens. So it's been... it's been cool for, you know, for a number of reasons that we have this opportunity to do this, and it means a lot to all of us.
Absolutely.
And it means a lot, by the way, to have the support from the community. So I have to thank you, and I have to thank the fans for that, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do this, period.
Thank you, Cal. Yeah, this is why one of the most requested kind of intercameras that we had too far. This is definitely like it's definitely a coming to fruition for our own time here with Hyphen, as well as our connection to you. Speaking of behind the scenes, take us through just like the moments of levity that made Sunnyside and the experience filming it so great for you. Like, in terms, you have such a litany, you have so many different weapons of comedy that you're working with on your cast. So like in sort of the shooting of it and in sort of developing the show, like were there moments that stick out to you in terms of working with the cast that are really iconic?
So I'll tell you the two things that stand out the most. One is going to make me very sentimental. I guess they'll both make me sentimental, but for different reasons. So this is I would say, with the exception of working on The Namesake, maybe, this is the only time, so for TV, certainly, this is the only time I can remember where I get to show up to work and never have to explain myself. I never get anybody who asks, and I think that goes for all of us.
Yeah.
Because the writer's room is all made up of either immigrants or the families of immigrants. So either immigrants themselves or the kids or spouse of an immigrant. So it is an immigrant writer's room, which means that you're starting from a place of never having to explain anything.
Right.
And I'm trying to, like, when I say anything, like, you know, for Asian American listeners, you know what I mean. Like, you never get a stupid question, or you never have to qualify something. You walk into a room as yourself. You're not walking into the room with the baggage that other people sort of put on you. Mm-hmm. And that was hugely liberating, and I wasn't expecting it, because I just didn't really know what that felt like, to walk into a room as you, to be seen for your humor or your artistic merit first before anything else. And that was awesome, and it goes for the cast too. It also meant that you could just really dive in on the comedy more than anything else. Okay, so that was the sentimental part of it, which is awesome, and I hope we get many more seasons, and I have to thank the fans for that again. But so the second thing is, so we're, you know, before we moved to Hulu from NBC Linear, NBC Linear has a lot of rules on what they do and don't want you to do. So we would have a lot of these meetings where they would talk you through, like, social media and do's and don'ts, and you have your harassment training and things that, you know, obviously I'm glad they do, but they're very strict. And so I remember a lot of the half of our cast are stand-up comics. So a lot of hands went up and people were like, wait a second. So can we not make certain jokes on our Twitter feed? Is that what you're saying? They're like, no. You can make any jokes you want, because a lot of your brand is like raunchy humor. You can do it. Just make sure that you don't do it in the context of you being on NBC. So we're like, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Cut to like the second episode airing, and Joel Kim Booster tweets, if the ratings improve, I will tweet a pic of my unshaven hole. And I was like, oh my God. I was on the floor laughing. So my first thought was, this is genius and hilarious, and it's so Joel Kim Booster and his sense of humor. And then my immediate second thought was, oh my God, I'm an executive producer. Am I going to get a phone call from the network saying, what is he doing? I never got a phone call from the network. And I ended up retweeting his tweet. So it's just, it's awesome because he is such a hilarious guy. And each of our cast members have such different senses of humor. I mean, you know Poppy in a personal capacity also. She's hilarious and so thoughtful and deep. And, you know, the entire cast is well-rounded and very different. So the jokes that are made every day on set are such a collection of everyone's different worlds and their worldview. And I love them so much.
Yeah, I have to redig that tweet from your Twitter, retweet it as well, just as a form, as a fashion.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
I also, we have a board up in the hair and makeup trailer, like, that changes every week with a quote, and the one that was up there the longest was definitely, I will tweet a pic of my unshaven hole. Joel Kim Booster.
Take a pic of it, frame it in a gold plaque. And just
well, that one's
it.
On my Instagram for sure. I think it's on one of the Insta stories that I saved. Feel free to use it.
Just like I will definitely use it for our media collateral for our publicity of the podcast as well. Just again, community solidarity at its finest too. It's funny, just, you know, for me, in my experience of doing these podcasts and these interviews and in-person encounters, is that there seems to be an aligning point, a moment when talent are in a creative space, not having to explain yourself, not having to do a backstory or to be confronted with microaggressions or interrogations of your race, of your gender, of your background. And like, it was moments like when I was interviewing the cast from the Crazy Rich Asians, saying like going into the casting room or going into the makeup and seeing a sea of people who look just like you and feeling, you know, a designated comfort to that.
Yeah.
It's hard to really put to words when you've been in the business as long as you have and never really having those isolated moments of just, you could call it freedom, you can call it liberation, you can just call it just comfort. But I think we have to really call in those times and say, hey, these are so vital to our own creative vitality, to our own expression, and to you just feeling good about working in entertainment. That's what I wanted to say. So
totally. And look, I remember it was probably a week or two into the show when, you know, I showed up to work one day and just had this thought of like, wait a second, is this what it's like for white people every day of their lives? This is amazing. What a privilege. Yeah. My goodness. It's being in a space that is inclusive and gets you and gets us and allows artists to tell their stories.
Right.
Yeah.
I think too, just like kind of seeing also just like your show's beginnings with NBC, thinking about other shows there as well as like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Superstore, that also carry a similar DNA of like diversity is there, but the diversity isn't sort of like the all card to like bring people into the show. You know, I think ultimately the mags that make it so specific and unique are what ultimately draw the fans in and wants to come back for more.
Definitely.
Too. So I think that was an element, thinking about the way that like humor is used to kind of like unify these disparate parts, I think was really effective and just like wanting to know and being curious about what's going to happen to these characters as we move on.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of your writer's room, how do you guys kind of deal with sort of the narrative of like Garrett's arc, other characters' arc, you know, whether it be, you know, the two twins being sort of reprimanded for their immaturity and kind of seeing how they kind of call in their own privilege and how that could be done in very humorous ways with them just like throwing out money as if it's like disease. I mean, that was like, she's like, here's 15. Like, I just, it's like you must have so much fun thinking about how to really navigate these, you know, these expanses of character.
Yeah, look, our writers are incredible, and Matt Murray, my co-creator, is our showrunner, and he's really the driver behind all of the different character arcs and every place they go. But having a writer's room that has no shortage of these experiences and have lived all of these lives really brings the beauty out in the characters. And so whenever they've got their little things that they're dealing with, and then obviously there's a huge subversive element to each plot line that is very much on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, where some of these guys are just idiots. I mean, by guys, I mean our characters.
Yeah.
Some of us are idiots and some of us are not. And it's all, you know, it's all done in a, I think in a way that's truthful to who these characters are.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just our writers are really, really, really talented.
Yeah. And I think both sort of the two-prong approach of the writers establishing those narratives, but also decisions from characterization as well. Like, I know as someone who's, like, very sensitive to, like, the portrayal of, like, Asian Americans on TV, obviously, given my background,
yeah.
But decision to not have the Asian characters have accents, or for that matter, when, like, Hakim has an accent, it's not done in a way that feels offensive or feels, like,
yeah.
distillating in terms of his character. So how were those decisions made in terms of, like, you know, Poppy and Joel are going to have, like, their own voices, really,
yeah.
within housed within these eccentric characters?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of everyone's backgrounds, I don't even think we directed anybody to have or not have accents. And I think part of that was because their point in the immigration process for all the characters, they're all at different points in their process. They all have different backgrounds and life stories.
Yeah.
In the case of Maylin and Jun Ho, you know, their backstory was that they probably went to a private school somewhere in Europe.
Yeah.
So if anything, I probably would have, you know, if the actors decided to have some sort of an accent, it would probably be something that's more European than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we wanted it to be truthful. I don't know. I think Samba's truth to the Hakim character that he brings to life happens to have an accent. He happens to be insanely nice, you know, but none of those things are one note about him. I mean, having done terrible accents in the past and having made the choice to take certain jobs back in the day to build a resume, I learned very quickly that oftentimes directors want stereotypical accents to mask bad writing. And they think that audiences will find it funny and therefore ignore jokes that have been made a million times before.
Yeah.
And once I realized that, I was like, oh, well, that's lame.
Because
because that's just lame artistically.
Yeah.
Like, that means you're assuming that your audience is dumb.
Yeah.
Before you're assuming that they're willing to root for a character based on the content. So I think, you know, point being, I think it's oftentimes even less about an accent itself and more about whether the writers are smart enough to ground the character in something.
And I think in the case of, I mean, that's a very astute observation. In the case of Hakim, you know, I think his choice of accent and the actor who plays him is ethnically Ethiopian as well, and he can kind of pull from those experiences. Those moments where he talks about, you know, language and using certain terms that are only expressed in Ethiopian to kind of, like, dismiss this, like, corrupt lawyer who is, you know, preying on immigrants who need help. I think those moments can be used to kind of, like, no, it actually meant that. It's like, I just think those are specific comedic gems that only happen when you, one, have a diverse room, but two, when you have actors who can really pull from that experience directly and bring, like, legitimate authenticity to it, too.
Yeah, so for sure. No, and Samba's such a treat. He's got, you know, born and raised in both Africa and Holland. He was on the Dutch version of The Daily Show. He speaks, what, 5 languages? 6 languages? I don't know. You know, it's like, what a world of experiences to draw from in bringing a character to life.
I love it. And speaking of just drawing from experiences, you know, I know it was touched upon earlier within our interview, but, like, I just want to know, just in terms of, I'd be remiss not to mention your time, obviously, as the associate director to the Office of Public Engagement of Obama. And I know you had mentioned, like, you know, not all of that sort of experience and time directly played into your time, you know, developing Sunnyside and specifically like a political character like Garrett. But I also know that, like, during your time on the Designated Survivor, you were a political consultant as well to kind of advise them. What was that role then, and was any of those elements taken into Sunnyside in terms of like that specific capacity?
Oh, interesting. Being an advisor? So on Designated Survivor, I was a consultant for all three seasons, and we went through, I think, 5 showrunners in 3 seasons. So your job as a consultant is interesting because your role is really, at least my role, was to obviously tell them what would truthfully happen or not truthfully happen, and then they make the decision whether they're going to do it anyway. So some showrunners that we had would want to know whether something would happen in real life. And if the answer was no, they would double down 3 times harder to make it happen because they liked that this would never happen in real life. Our last showrunner was the opposite, where he said, no, I need to know whether this would or would not happen in real life because we only want to do things that would happen in real life.
Right.
Because to him, and I think that was the right choice ultimately, that heightens the drama. That really grounds the world a lot more than making something up. But that none of that was my decision, right? So it was funny because sometimes we would have things, particularly seasons 1 and 2, that like would just never happen in a million years.
Yeah.
And so I'd have my White House buddies texting me like, yo, episode 5 was such bullshit. That like would never happen. Why don't you say something? I'm like, now hang on. I said something. And that's why they did it wrong, because they wanted it wrong. So it was fun, though, you know, because you're making TV at the end of the day and you're making fiction. So sometimes you do it right and sometimes you purposely do it wrong. Whatever heightens the story for the showrunners at the time. But that was not really... So that experience was different. I actually said no to Designated Survivor when I first heard about the project because I didn't think it would be challenging. I was like, I worked in the real White House. I don't really want to do a White House show. And then I realized, well, that's wrong because the analogy, I'm playing a press secretary. So it's like if I had been a real airline mechanic and then did a play where I was playing a flight attendant.
Right.
Like, I know nothing about being a flight attendant. I would have to do all that research. And so it was sort of like that where, you know, I know nothing about being a press secretary. And it was a challenging role and I loved it. I think the only reason Garrett in Sunnyside is a politician not because of any of my experiences, nor even Designated Survivor, but we were trying to find a place from which he could rebuild his life.
Yeah.
And the fall from grace meant that he had to be something that could provide that fall.
Yeah.
And so at first I thought, okay, maybe he's a lawyer. Maybe he's been disbarred somehow and therefore has no job. And Matt Murray, genius co-creator, was like, what if his fall from grace is like a like an Anthony Weiner-esque thing minus the sex offender stuff, where you just, there's no way to rebuild your life, but in a way that's absurd or more absurd more absurd than getting disbarred. So he based that opening scene, the footage of Garrett getting arrested, on a hockey player whose name I'm blanking on, but this happened like 20 years ago maybe.
Yeah.
This hockey player gets pulled over for a DUI and tries to bribe the cop and says, I'll give you $10,000 if you let me off. Don't you know who I am? And the cop's like, yes, I know who you are. Please don't do this.
Yeah.
He goes, fine, $100,000. You know, $1 million. And then finally offers him $1 billion. That's how trashed he is. And the cop, they can't prosecute him for bribery because obviously he doesn't have $1 billion, right? And so when Matt was recounting this, I was like, oh my God, dude, yes. Make him a politician, and definitely that's his downfall. How could you not? And he's like, it's good, right? I'm like, yes, it's really good. So that's how that ends up as the place from which Garrett then needs to rebuild his life. So obviously, natural question, did it have anything to do with the White House?
Yeah. Like,
no, it really had to do with this hockey player.
Oh my God. It just seems more and more that we're talking, like, there are so many moments within the show that are taken from actual people, actual moments in time that...
There's really... a lot of realism.
Yeah.
You know, you take the most bizarre things that you read about and heighten them. And
I want to say especially too, just like, given like what we've seen with the administration and like what sees like a fall from grace, so many people stepping down, but also on a larger sort of macro scale, the nature of like cancel culture that we live in 2019, where people have been, you know, and rightfully so, sort of disbarred and disavowed from public eye because of truly heinous behavior. But I think it's like what this show provides is an opportunity for like, especially like a man to just say, hey, like, you know, he's done sort of unsavory things, but what does that path to rehabilitation, reconciliation look like on a social level? And I think part of that comes from like investing in the community too. So I think there's so many ways that it complements, like, this story of building community and building inclusive with one individual person's, like, misstep and being, yeah, an idiot and bribing a cop. So
yeah, yeah. I mean, look, Garrett's story is a redemption story, and you don't always root for him. Mm. You see him continue to slip up, like all humans do.
Yeah.
Right. We've all had our bad days or done things that we wish we hadn't done and are trying to be better people and rebuild. And Garrett is a prime example of that. So there are episodes where you see him, like, even his decision whether or not to help these folks at certain times, you know, when, like, episode 2, when Griselda is trying to explain to Garrett that she thinks that Hakeem might be a hitman, yeah, or something bad is going on and he needs our help. Really, Garrett only does it because he gets off on the fact that he might know a hitman. He's like, yeah, oh, that's so cool. You might be a hitman. That's, yeah, awesome, right? I mean, initially he goes along with her because he made a promise.
Yeah.
But at no point does he go along with her because he knows it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big problem that he's still, even on this redemption path, like, he still can't help himself.
Yeah.
He's still getting in his own way. And I thought that's truthful of a lot of people's experiences. Yeah. So, you know, I'm glad you put it that way, because, yeah, I think, again, it goes back to our characters being flawed, and there's a power to them being flawed, and all humans are flawed in real life, and we wanted to, you know, make sure that our characters are too.
You know, invariably flawed, invariably quirky too. I think, yeah, for Griselda, my favorite gag is it just seems like she works like 300,000 jobs in New York, yeah, City. Like, I hope that's like a consistent thread throughout the entire series.
Because it's consistent, yeah, and
it always hits. Just want to say.
When you, yeah, I don't know if you saw this week's episode, but there, you know, she has to take time off here and there, or not take time off, but schedule different things. So episode, what is it, 7, I guess. You finally meet her wife, and they're going through their immigration process. And so a fantastic comedian named Fortune who plays her wife, there's a really funny scene where they're sitting down with, like, the immigration interview, and Garrett kind of barges in, but it's more about him than it is about them, and he's, yeah, drunk for half the episode. And it's Griselda bringing, you know, Deanna bringing Griselda to life in that way. For us, it was purposely very layered, where, mm-hmm, she's hilarious. She's got all these jobs. She's got these scheduling issues. obviously, they're in a same-sex relationship going through an immigration hearing at a time when our government is very much going after same-sex couples,
yeah,
and their immigration process.
And their rights.
And their rights, their, yeah, human rights. And obviously, that's on purpose. We're telling that story for a reason.
Yeah.
And we're telling it subversively for a reason, because if you can laugh with and identify with our communities, then, you know, the hope is that we're all humanized a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so so all of that under the umbrella of, like, a drunk, flawed Garrett,
yeah,
who still can't help himself, was the balance for us between Deanna's hilarious stuff that she brings, and then just Garrett still being a flawed person who's obsessed with Rob Gronkowski.
Yeah. And again, even in a post-retirement world, just holding on to the hope that
you gotta love Gronk, man. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Literally Iron Man. And that just got me thinking too, just about, you know, specifically about the perception of the show, you know, obviously coming from progressive minds and a progressive construction, but also thinking about the idea that, like, media is so truly ubiquitous,
mm-hmm,
and there are parts of this country and even parts of our viewership that may lean conservative. And
sure.
I think I kind of want to ask, like, do you see Sunnyside as a function of, like, a bipartisan product, meaning, yeah, for viewership across America who are first tuning into the show for the first time, being on a network and now kind of being explored, how they consume it, like, is there an idea of, like, how you want to touch base with the entirety of the population as opposed to just telling one story to one ideology?
And, yeah, man, look, yeah, there's a reason that I sold the show to NBC and that I'm proud that it's on Hulu as opposed to taking it to a streamer from the start.
Yeah.
Because we wanted the sentiment to be accessible to everybody, right, and wanted it to be at a place that people can enjoy it for what it is, which is a comedy. It's, mm-hmm, the only number one goal, not only, the number one goal is to make people laugh.
Yeah.
And of course, there are tons of folks in the Asian American Pacific Islander community who are extremely conservative.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, people, when we've talked about Garrett's view of identity is very much not the son of immigrants. Mm. He doesn't fully identify with his parents' immigration experience in any meaningful way. His sister does.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know any of it, nor does he identify. And there's a lot of Nikki Haley and Bobby Jindal in Garrett. Right? There's a lot of, like, the way that he chooses to identify is very different. And that's not meant to chastise any folks on the right. We want them to enjoy the show just as well. The thing that I think we will never apologize for is the reality of the America that we live in, which is inclusive and is beautiful and should have a seat at the table. That's not negotiable because that's the reality of the world that we live in. So I'm not interested in propping up somebody who doesn't necessarily want strong LGBT women in episode 7.
Yeah.
Well, that's your problem. What I do want to create are strong LGBT women in episode 7 who you're laughing with and loving because for the 22 minutes you're watching the show, you've tuned out the rest of the world. So if we do our job properly, it doesn't really matter the background of the characters if you're just watching the show to enjoy the show.
True.
And you know, there's nothing in the show that's not based in reality. So I think our conservative fans should enjoy the show and should continue to enjoy the show, and hopefully they do.
Yeah, and then I think it stems from this, and I appreciate you saying that, Cal, is that, you know, oppression isn't fiction at the end of the day. Oppression, marginalization, erasure is not fiction. It is a living, breathing, heinous reality that we have to constantly subvert and dismend. So I think, you know, you kind of capitalizing on in that in this lane, I think, has such potency. And I think,
Thank you. And I'll tie it to Harold and Kumar a little bit, because that was something that, you know, when that movie came out, it didn't do well in the box office. Mm-hmm. It got pulled after like 2 weeks. And the general sentiment in Hollywood was, well, see, two Asian American men, they just can't open a movie. Nobody wants to see Asian American men in a comedy.
Right.
And it was really kind of disappointing for a few months because I started to wonder if that was true.
Right.
And I said, that's not the America that I know, but maybe all these old white dudes are right. Maybe America doesn't want to see two Asian American men in a comedy. 3 months later, however long it was, when Harold and Kumar dropped on HBO and then came out on DVD with virtually no marketing, fans found the movie and bought the DVD and started watching it and having watch parties. And they did that not just along the coast, but they did that in Kansas and Oklahoma and Minnesota. And people had frat parties where they would watch the movie before they, like, went out for the night. And that was not just in the Asian American community. That was tons of white folks, many of whom are deeply conservative and loved Harold and Kumar because the characters were relatable to them.
Yeah.
They reminded them of blonde friends of theirs, which is really what fiction should be. It should be an attachment. We want you to laugh because you identify with the characters in some way. And what I love about Sunnyside is we're aiming for that. So this sort of speaks to, like, why I still very much hope and think that conservative viewers should love it just as much as the folks on the left, although for different reasons. But at the end of the day, like, these are characters that you want to laugh with. And if we've done our jobs properly, you will laugh with them.
Exactly.
We're also not stupid and purposely are representing our communities for a reason. There's no other show out there that's doing it like this. And I'm very proud that we are. You know, I won't shy away from that. But I think there's something in the show for everybody.
Yeah. And I think and even more than that, just like taking a stand, just like actually having a voice and having a perspective on issues that maybe some shows ordinarily would be skirtish away from. And I think that's so valuable. And I think to kind of cap things off too, and then you get the perfect segue, just like, you know, turn the looking glass into your own career.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of your, in the time that you spend, you know, in just the entire cavalcade of characters you have portrayed who identify as South Asian, you know, everyone, you know, that we've mentioned from Harold to Seth to your time working on House MD to even now with Garrett, like, where do you see Garrett falling under the pantheon of like South Asian? Because you have such an opportunity and like fortune, like to basically have chance to subvert, upend, promote, sort of, you know, the identity of South Asian culture and in America.
You know, it's funny. This reminds me. It's a very different question, but this reminds me of, I sometimes around election time, I usually get the question, like, hey, who would Kumar vote for? He'd vote for my candidate, right?
Yeah.
And the real answer is, if Kumar were a real person, he probably doesn't vote.
Yeah.
Like, the dude is definitely not registered to vote. He does not care. And if he were going to vote, he'd probably vote for Ron Paul or something.
Yeah.
Like, he's probably a weird libertarian at the end of the day. So, So it's funny because the Garrett question, it's I think we'll see where his arc goes. But both he and his sister, their names, I should have mentioned, you know, is sort of the beginning of that conversation for me, where I've played characters like Gogol in The Namesake, and then I've played characters like Seth on Designated Survivor. Mm-hmm. And I find that when Twitter is never a good marker for these conversations, but it's amusing because when you play a character with an ethnically Indian name, folks will say, how come his name couldn't be Todd? Why did you have to make him Indian? Then you play a guy named Todd, and people are like, how come his name can't be Nikhil? So there's like a no-win situation, right?
Wait,
and
truly,
by the way, super valid, okay? Like, I get that our images and seeing our names and all of that representation is totally valid.
Yeah.
But it's a no-win situation when you're looking at those things back-to-back. So I was trying to come up with an interesting way that was authentic for what are Garrett and Mallory's names. And the reason they're named Garrett and Mallory, I think we get to this in, not to spoil it, but episode 9, I think you finally get the backstory, where, so their parents moved to America and fell in love with American TV, and their favorite show was Different Strokes.
Oh my God.
And they especially loved how hardworking Mrs. Garrett was. So they're like, oh wow, this is a very hardworking woman. Then they start watching The Facts of Life, and Mrs. Garrett is also in The Facts of Life. And the parents are like, oh my God, she is literally the most hardworking woman in America. Our firstborn son has to be named after Mrs. Garrett. So they name him Garrett. And then they start watching Family Ties, and Mallory is named after Mallory from Family Ties. The irony being Mallory, the character, was a slacker on Family Ties, and Mallory in our show is really hardworking.
Yeah.
Mrs. Garrett was very hardworking. My character Garrett is anything but.
Right.
And it was more of a hat tip to American television. It's more of a hat tip to a lot of immigrants who learn about American culture or language through TV. And then also solved the dilemma of, well, what should their names be? And
right.
I thought it would be a fun way to root it in really celebrating television, which is something that I love.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
It's a tribute. It's a nod. It's a recognition of that experience.
Yeah. So. Doesn't fully answer your question, but I think the point of that was that identity can be complicated for people. And I don't think, you know, I'm not necessarily a fan of cultural ambassadorship. Like, why should I get to answer the question about what somebody's identity should be or how they choose to identify? A lot of, you know, even the sort of conversation that folks have about being, you know, did you feel more Indian or more American when you were growing up? I was in that sort of rare situation. I was the outlier in the sense that I grew up in a pretty diverse town. A lot of people were bilingual. They were speaking Polish and English at home, or, you know, it was a predominantly Jewish town, so you'd go to bar and bat mitzvahs every weekend in 7th and 8th grade. So the idea that you had to pick one or the other was not necessarily my experience.
Right.
But it is a pretty predominant experience for folks. And that's, you know, so whenever I get those questions, I was like, well, why should I push my experience, which is also valid in its own way?
Of course.
So the hat tip for Garrett and Mallory was that we wanted them to have their own unique experiences as well. And when you meet their parents in the Thanksgiving episode next week, I'm actually curious to see what you think of the parents, but their journey, you learn, is purposely, it's more about what makes them tick as people, and less about their sacrifice as immigrants. At least the first time you meet them.
Right.
So it's it's basically a dysfunctional family Thanksgiving episode, right? Which could
Marked
be anybody. Message.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's always so funny just like how crucial like the presentation of the parent characters for characters of color. Because there's always going to be a stipulation about the immigrant narrative, about being sort of, you know, transitioned in terms of your times of American identity. And I think that's something that's exciting to explore because it's so fruitful in terms of representation.
Yeah, I just finished reading Sopan Deb's new book. It's coming out. He sent me an advanced copy. It's fantastic, by the way. But it's about his life story and his parents.
Yeah.
And, you know, them getting divorced when he was a little kid and not really being connected with his dad who had moved back to India. And these are stories that we don't often talk about in the Asian American community.
Yeah.
Even the idea of divorce in the South Asian community is still a whisper word, like cancer and gay. Like, it's crazy that any of these are whispered words. But so I think any time that we have the chance to talk about them. And in some cases, you're talking about them by not talking about them. Like, right. in the case of Garrett and Mallory's parents in the Thanksgiving episode, their dysfunction comes from being human, not from being South Asian. And and so you're addressing dysfunction and highlighting dysfunction by oddly by not contextualizing it through the lens of ethnicity, but by virtue of the characters being present as brown folks on a network comedy, like, you're achieving that at the same time, you know?
Exactly. And I think there's a phrase I've fastened as half my own prayer to thinking about the larger scope of representation, is that existence is resistance. And a lot of times it's just kind of like dwelling on that and seeing these shows where it's like, oh, there's so many diverse characters. I have to like actively keep track of who's who. It's like, that's almost like a luxury to have sometimes too within this specific lens. So I think it's
crazy to me that it's 2019 and we find out through journalists that we're the most diverse show that's ever existed on television. That never happened before.
Yeah.
Like, nobody wanted to do that.
Like,
it doesn't happen. Like, look, I loved Seinfeld. Friends was an enjoyable show. They're two of the whitest shows on television. I don't know those New Yorks, and I grew up right outside of New York City.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I just don't know their versions of New York. That's a choice. It's a choice to exclude communities of color from those shows. And that was a choice they made, and those shows did really well, and they're really funny.
Yeah.
But it's still bonkers to me that we're the most diverse show that's ever existed and happens to take place in New York City and is patriotic on purpose because we love America, right? So,
yeah.
I think basically what you were saying, Poppy talked about that a little bit in a recent interview, I think with Pride.com, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said something like, just by virtue of our bodies being on TV, it automatically is, I don't know if she said activist or if she said, but just the presence of that representation does mean something.
It's powerful, and I think it's a powerful statement to both embody and to really end on. And I think just by concluding things here too, for Cal, what's going on next? What's next on your radar?
I got to do the plug for the show because we only get to make these if people watch them. And so, you know, the nice part about being on streaming and no longer on linear is that you don't have to tune in every Thursday at 9:30, which, like, aside from people's grandmas and aunties, who actually does that? So watch them, binge them, especially during the holidays if you can. Great Thanksgiving content with the fam, especially given the families look like ours. And, you know, plow through those 10 or 11 episodes, and hopefully we'll get a second season. And then outside of that, I'm working on a book.
Awesome.
I'm not developing any TV right now because we're waiting to see if we get a second season. So hopefully we can build some of these characters, and then we'll see what happens next year.
Well, Cal, as a fan from 15 years ago to now seeing with you today here in West Hollywood and speaking on behalf of Hyphen Air Community, I just want to thank you so much for offering your time. This has been a really insightful conversation, and for his own remarks, support Sunnyside, support diverse creators, and just support content that speaks to our truth.
Thank you.
Keep things moving.
Well, I got to say thank you, and thank you to all the listeners and your audience for all the continued years of support. You guys have always supported the artistic community and told stories broadly that otherwise don't get told. So thank you.
Absolutely, my friend.
I appreciate it.
See you next time.
Yeah.
Awesome.